Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
Welcome, welcome, welcome into the show. It is Thursday, October 9th. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I am Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
So this year, for the first time in 50 years, Camden, New Jersey recorded zero homicides during the summer season. But this marks a tremendous turnaround from just 13 years ago when Camden, New Jersey was one of the most dangerous cities in the country. Change began when Camden dismantled the city's police force and launched the Camden County Police Department. The emphasis was on community policing. And over the past decade plus, transformation came, but it wasn't all sweet tea and roses. There were bumps along the way, but they got a lot of things right. And there's still, though, a lot of work to do. So today we're going to pull back the curtain. We're going to look at what Camden did, what strategies the CCPD employed, how they course corrected, and a whole lot more. You're going to hear from law enforcement, as well as a community resident and activist. And one of our panelists has studied this issue and wrote a whole book about it. And we want to hear from you, our listeners, what's your perception of Camden? How has it changed over time? And what do you think needs to change to bring crime down in other parts of the region? The number to participate is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, share the video, but leave your comment in the chat.
And we're going to take a real hard look at this.
Yeah.
It's not just all hype train this hour.
Nope.
Because we also have to level set. I mean, last year, Camden had, for its history, a very low crime rate, still higher than the city of Philadelphia, mm-hmm. which gives you a sense of perhaps how far policing can go in solving the problems of a city with high, high concentrations of poverty mm-hmm. and rapid deindustrialization. So we're going to take a clear-eyed look at all of this. There's also some controversial things that the Camden police did, including lots of surveillance technology. Mm-hmm. So we'll talk about that as well. I see a comment already with someone raising that as an issue. So get your comments in. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. It's also DJ of the day. We will end the Thursday show, as we do every Thursday, with a song picked by one of you related to the theme of today's show. Perhaps you could pick someone with a connection to Camden, New Jersey.
Yeah.
RCA Victor, et cetera, et cetera. It's
or
up to you.
Or about change.
Maybe change.
You know,
who knows?
Living in the city.
EP Kevin will judge all of the submissions and pick one of you to round out the hour. You can email that song choice to studio2@whyy.org.
And now our trio of news stories.
And we should start in New Jersey.
Yeah, of course.
Of course.
Of course.
Over it's a Jersey show today. Perhaps not surprising, but the second and final debate in the New Jersey governor's race got a little contentious last night. Republican Jack Cittarelli and Democrat Mikey Sherrill clashed over immigration, taxes, Trump, and more. One of the tensest moments, however, had to do with opioids. This was an exchange that Sherrill and Cittarelli had about a medical publishing company that Cittarelli once owned. I think we have the clip teed up. Let's hear some of that.
I got the walk at my college graduation.
And, I'm so glad that you then went on to kill tens of thousands of people in New Jersey, including children.
And I never broke the
as
law.
They got,
I
you
never
just broke,
the,
broke
law.
The law. In fact, your campaign right now is under federal investigation for how you illegally got access to my records. So to say that right now, and I think you're trying to divert from the fact that you killed tens of thousands of people by
you
printing
broke the law.
Your misinformation, your propaganda, and then getting paid to develop an app so that people could more easily get the opioids once they were addicted.
So there's a lot going on in that clip, just to break it down a little bit. What Cittarelli is accusing Sherrill of there has to do with her time at the Naval Academy as a student. She was not allowed to graduate. She was not allowed to walk at graduation.
She did graduate.
She graduated. She didn't walk at graduation. She says it's because she did not turn in other students in a cheating scandal that was going on at the time. Not that she cheated herself. Cittarelli has denied that, asked her to release full records. Someone in his campaign also got the federal government to release records of her entire naval service that should not have been released. They were not permitted to be released. So it's very messy, but you could hear it there. Clearly, end of a campaign. Things are getting acrimonious.
For sure. I mean, and the polls, you know, show that there's a slight edge with Cheryl, but not a big one. And it's a very competitive race. I mean, and the two candidates are clearly fighting for position. And, you know, with Cittarelli seems to be sticking with local issues, where Cheryl, she keeps trying to tie Cittarelli to Trump and saying that he's a Trump loyalist. I don't know. It seems like it's getting really bitter. We've seen a lot of the ads that are very kind of vicious on both sides of the aisle. And the question is whether or not, you know, this will move the needle at this point in the race, you know, or have folks kind of made up their mind. I'm sure there's a lot of folks who are just starting to pay attention with a month out to Election Day. So, I mean, we'll see whether or not this will move the needle.
Story number two.
Oh, yeah. A Phoenixville company has figured out a way to turn sewage, a.k.a. poop, into a form of coal. Yeah, yeah, you're probably looking at the picture. Yes, that's what it is. A little lump of coal right there. Cool story by WHYY Sophia Schmidt. I mean, the company is called SoMax, and they're doing the wastewater treatment for the borough of Phoenixville in Chester County. They take the sewage sludge from Phoenixville residents, and they run it through a process called hydrothermal carbonization, which uses pressure and heat and the range of an oven to speed up the fossil fuel formation that usually takes millions of years. And boom, out comes a brown dirt or rock-like substance that they call biocoal.
Biocoal.
Yeah. And they're calling it guilt-free coal because it burns like coal, but it's much better for the environment because it traps much of the carbon that would otherwise be released into the atmosphere from sewage sludge. Pretty fascinating stuff. The new $6 million Phoenixville facility is a collaboration between SoMax and the borough and is believed to be one of the first of its kind to break ground in North America.
And by the way, in addition to being burned like coal, the material could be used to make bricks or cement, which means someday you could literally S-H-I-T bricks.
I was not expecting you to say that, but yes, you
could.
That's
literally true.
And you could, it'll be all over the walls, you know? And so there's that. And so, and the wonderful thing is,
oh my God,
it does trap the carbon in the walls and everything. And it's supposed to be good. One of the downsides to this, though, for the community residents is that the process gives off a funky odor. It's been likened to burnt cabbage. And apparently,
I like cabbage, though, to be honest. I don't know what the smell is like, but I like cabbage.
I don't know if I like it burnt, but there's that. And but SoMax is working to get a supercharged air filter that'll fix that. But yeah, this is the future.
This is interesting. I was a little confused and surprised by the branding of biocoal. Mm-hmm. Why would you want to link it to coal? Just call it something like that.
Call it something new.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like that's going to raise people's red flags. Like, I would love to be in the pitch meeting where they were like, what should we call this thing? Biocoal. I was shocked by that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that's what they're calling it. Maybe they'll come up with a new name to sell it in a broader fashion. But and it kind of looks like a little rock. I mean, it looks like a little brown coal rock.
I get that. But, you know, coal is, people have a dirty association with that.
Yeah.
Maybe remanurables.
Ooh, not that's bad, good. Right? Remanurables. I mean, you love stuff like this. I was getting a kick out of this. Yeah.
Emergy.
There's so many options here, but you're right. Maybe they need to put you on the marketing
team. Or just colon coal. I mean, I just think maybe get fun with it if you're going to do coal. Anyways, third
colon
story.
Colon coal.
Pennsylvania.
Yes, people.
Pennsylvania State Parks have seen the future, and the future, folks, I hate to break it to you, is glamping.
Oh, yes.
According to an announcement earlier this week, 8 state parks in the Commonwealth are about to introduce glamping options. That means glamorous camping, by the way. Mm-hmm. According to the Inky, these glamping setups include a nice big white tent, ceiling fans, mini fridge, coffee maker, and more. The cost is between $130 and $220 a night. The closest glampery for us here in our region will be the French Creek State Park in Chester County. This is a way to appeal to folks who might not be into traditional camping. Give them a little glamping setup. And Cherry Gregg is pointing to herself here. You would be interested in glamping. You are not interested in camping.
Yes. Well, they have heat, AC, real beds. Love it. Love it. And I'm those people that they're trying to appeal to. Call me Cherry the Glamper Gregg.
I will. Cherry the Glamper Gregg.
And
there you go.
I'm totally down. I think I could convince my friends to do this. By the way,
why would you just stay in a hotel, though?
But because you want to be in nature and you want to be able to go hiking
and
things.
A hotel in a nature spot.
Yeah, and you can go outside.
No, I'm saying you could just stay in a hotel in a nature spot.
Yeah, but then you're closer to outside here.
But you don't want to be closer to outside.
Maybe a little bit, but I just want a coffee maker. You know what I mean? Like, this is great.
You would never tent camp. You just wouldn't do that.
I have in the past as a child, but I like a little bit.
You did it once as a kid and never again. That's not a...
And the bugs love me. So I feel like
your natural bug spray recommendations too. I totally get it. And I will confess, we do tent camping.
Yeah.
But we bring a blow up bed. Gotta have the blow up mattress.
So you kind of glamp.
It's sort of glamping.
Glamping light.
Yeah. So it's everyone's on the spectrum of this somewhere. So I don't judge people who glamp because I'm doing it a little bit myself.
It might be gateway to regular camping. You never know.
That's the hope.
Yeah.
That's the hope. So speaking of hope, we're going to talk about Campton. Some hopeful signs there in terms of crime reduction. We'll be right back here on Studio 2. Don't go anywhere. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Let's start with a little history. In 2003, Camden, New Jersey had the highest violent crime rate of any American city with 75,000 people or more. For the next decade, that rate barely budged. Then in 2013, a monumental shift.
The city disbanded its local police department and replaced it with something called the Camden County Police Department. Now, a lot of the officers did remain, but the deployment of those officers changed dramatically. More of them were tasked with community policing. They also had access to far more surveillance technology and at least initially began issuing lots of tickets for low-level offenses.
It's now been a dozen years since that big change, and the results are striking. Camden just recorded a summer with zero homicides. Is it a policing miracle or something more complicated? Our guest today wrote a book exploring many of these questions. John Sharback is associate professor of criminal justice at Rowan University and author of Chasing Change in Camden, Police Reform in One of America's Most Violent Cities. John, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you guys for having me.
Yeah, we're so glad to have you here, John. Excited to get into this conversation. We want to hear from you out there, listeners, viewers. What's your perception of Camden? Has that perception changed over time? What needs to change to bring crime down in other parts of the region? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
And so, John, I want you to take us back to 2012, the year before the city of Camden dismantled its police department. What was happening inside that department, what was happening inside the city that made it say, you know what, it's time for a serious change?
Well, 2012 was an absolutely horrific year in Camden. They ended the year with 67 homicides, 21 of them in the summer months of June, July, and August. And just to put that number in perspective, mm-hmm. if New York City had that same homicide rate, given population, New York City would have had more than 7,300 homicides in that year, opposed to their 419. So Camden had more than 17 times the homicide rate of our nation's biggest city and 18 times larger than the national average.
And so what was happening in the department there, the CPD at the time?
So CPD, since January of 2011, in 2011, we were feeling the effects of the Great Recession. And in January of that year, the Camden mayor was forced to lay off nearly half of her police department. And so what resulted was a department that was largely demoralized, overworked, largely due to the rumblings that they were going to be taken over, that their police department was going to be disbanded and rebuilt from the ground up in the form of the Camden County PD.
Wow.
This is a quote from the chief, J. Scott Thompson. The cultural current, the flow of water, was really established by the labor union at the time, and their mindset was embrace the status quo, we'll circle the wagons, and we'll just outweigh anyone that comes in and tries to give us direction. Why didn't that happen? There was huge resistance from the police union, understandably.
Right.
Somehow the political forces were aligned to break that blockade. I know people probably don't want to hear all the boring politics, but a little bit of politics would help here, John. Give us a little bit of a rundown.
Right. So, and by the way, Scott Thompson, who wrote the foreword of my book, when he was hired as interim chief and then later chief, he was asking officers to, blow up the status quo, get out of your cars, no more administrative tasks. He wanted to disband this traffic unit, which we could probably talk about in a little bit. And as a result, he had 100 formal grievances and 8 lawsuits filed against him by his own department. So that just gives you kind of the scale of what he was up against.
A true culture clash going on here.
Exactly. So he's the chief. The New Jersey Attorney General, Ann Milgram, has superseded the Camden Police Department starting in 2003. And so when the current chief and the New Jersey Attorney General that has taken over the department can't get things done, that is a problematic organization. And that's kind of what that organization was like: mismanaged, dysfunctional, not really engaged in policing. Policing isn't just a noun; it's also a verb.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so, when you have, you know, a department that is, you know, apathetic and lethargic and not getting out of their cars and being in the neighborhoods where crime is most likely to occur, we see the years of, you know, 2011 through 2012.
Yeah, and one of the things Scott Thompson talked about, he looked at some video and he said he was kind of ashamed. He looked at video at one particular corner that he saw no police cars, no police presence at all, except when there was an actual shooting. So what were community members sort of experiencing during this time, you know, as far as police services before the dismantling took place?
Very little policing, which is problematic in a city that is highly economically and socially disadvantaged.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't just Scott, it was Ann Milgram. She, on her first day as Attorney General, she drove all around the city and she said she saw a lot of things that day. She saw young kids not in school dealing drugs, but the one thing that she did not see was a Camden police officer.
Yeah, and I think response rates were like an hour.
An hour.
Called 911.
Yeah.
It would take an hour to get.
That's largely a function of, well, half the department was laid off. Slowly but surely, they got their jobs back eventually. But there was also a daily absentee rate of about 30%. So there just weren't enough officers to handle the calls. And so that's what led to response times being 60 minutes. Which, again, like when you look at that and you're trying to contemplate, was this the right move? We need to take into account how dysfunctional the old agency was.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the political will is gathered to get rid of a police department, which you don't find a lot of precedent for that. So they replace it with this thing called the Camden County Police Department, though initially it only is responsible for the city of Camden, right? Sort of a misnomer in name.
Exactly. Yeah. So for the first 10, 11 years, it only policed the city of Camden.
So what was truly different about it then, I think, is what people, just structurally, organizationally, separate from the tactics that they used.
Gotcha.
What was different about the organization itself, how it compensated people, its sort of internal structure?
So they really just started engaging in police work. There was a lot of internal controls placed on officers. There's GPS in the cars. There's GPS in the department-issued cell phones. There's GPS in the body-worn cameras. And so they have this real-time crime center in the headquarters, and they have like different zones throughout the city. And when an officer is not in his or her allotted zone, it moves from green to yellow, yellow to red. And so
the officers are being watched far more closely.
Exactly. Yeah. There are way more internal controls placed on the officers today and in the Camden County PD.
They also get more officers, right? And my understanding from your book is that they found a way to, and this is, you know, going to be controversial, pay the officers, each officer, less in terms of total compensation when you add up all the ancillary, you know, benefits, overtime, things like that. I mean, that happened, right?
It did. So before the change, they were only able to pay for a department that had around 250, 260 officers. With the reformation, they're able to have, I think, 411.
For the same money.
For the same money.
But that basically comes with breaking the union.
They did break
the union. That's what unlocked the ability to pay people less per head. I mean, is that more or less true?
Yeah. So they, first of all, financial details have never really been that forthcoming.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to point to something. So the Camden City Council had to vote on this. And the Camden City Council members weren't even privy to the financial and logistical details of this new plan. In fact, one Camden County Camden City Councilman, Brian Coleman, he wanted the details in order to vote, and he was never provided any. And he was the lone dissenter who voted no. The rest of the city council voted yes.
Yeah, because 6 of 7 city council members voted for it. The mayor was on board with this. A lot of the politicians at the time were all on, all for it. But the people who were against it were like the NAACP, some community activists, the union, of course.
Exactly.
What were the big reasons why people objected?
So, to your point, there were strange bedfellows. Yeah. In the Camden County chapter of the NAACP and the city's FOP.
Yeah, for union. Yeah.
Yeah, for once they agreed they didn't want to dismantle this police department. And I think why it happened, it's largely a function of the fact that Camden City, because they have such low population, they don't have a lot of political power in the county. So mm-hmm. in 1960, they had about a third of the county's population.
Camden was huge. It was booming. There was all sorts of industry.
124,000 people lived in Camden in the 1950 census. But in 1980, that 33% dropped down to 16%. And I would venture to say that it's much lower today with the growth of places like Cherry Hill and all other municipalities in the state.
So their relative power shrinking.
And then you throw in the fact that they were under state control since 2002.
So they didn't have the money, the tax base. Yeah.
Camden is very unique in that they only collect taxes for about 15% of their municipal budget. 85% of their municipal budget comes from state aid.
Wow.
So they were at the mercy of Camden County, the state of New Jersey, and because Governor Chris Christie at the time wanted this. He ran on a platform of consolidating services. Mm-hmm. That's what you saw. You saw asymmetrical power dynamics.
The city is basically no longer the master of its fate. It doesn't really control its finances. The political powers in the state want change, and they get change.
Exactly. And I think to your point earlier, you know, you were discussing why object to this. Mm-hmm. There's something very undemocratic about having a police department that is not controlled locally. You know, you have Camden County that is relatively whiter and affluent, that is controlling the policing for largely poor black and brown people. You know, Camden is 95% black and Hispanic. And although things have definitely gotten better, which we could talk about, that might rub people the wrong way. Mm-hmm. And especially the entire process through which the new police department came to be. There's a lot of questions.
And so a question that kept sticking in my head is, what does dismantling or what does starting a police department from scratch allow you to do that you can't do if you were simply reforming a police department?
Well, I think a lot of that has to do with the labor union. You know, basically when on April 30th, 2013, the last day of the Camden City PD's 141 year run, when that ended, so did the labor union. And the officers actually weren't unionized until October 1st of 2013.
So there's this crucial gap.
Mm-hmm. Which even when President Barack Obama was in Camden in 2015, he actually got that point wrong. You know, he said you created a new police department while keeping it unionized. Yeah, but not for the first 6 months.
Yep.
Yeah. And so...
And there's a big shuffling of deck and responsibility going on at that time.
Exactly.
Yeah. And let's talk about a little bit of that, mm-hmm. right? So this is... I think I have this stat right from your book. So in a typical department, maybe 20 to 30% of the officers would be assigned to community policing duties. In Camden, that number went to 70 to 80%?
Yeah.
So most of the officers are doing sort of what we would call community policing. So what does that mean they are actually doing?
So they're out, they're out of their squad cars, they're walking around on foot patrol, interacting with people, small businesses, they're out on bike, talking to people. And that was a major change. You know, mm-hmm. most police departments dedicate the majority of their officers to patrol, responding to calls for service. And while about 30% of the Camden County PD did that in the early years, the 70% were in charge of these neighborhood response teams, yeah. where they were told to get out, walk around in some of the most violent places in the city, what we call hotspots, areas of significant criminal activity. And they walked the beat, they rode their bikes, they talked to people. They stopped a lot of people early on.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Huge mm-hmm. uptick in tickets for low-level offenses. I think there was one that I wrote down. Tickets for riding a bicycle without a light went from 2 to 240. Yeah. Now, they did reverse course on this, it seemed like, John, but that did happen in the early years. Why did they do that, and was there any evidence that it was effective?
So they... First of all, they were under a tremendous amount of political pressure to reform. You know, nobody wants the notoriety of murder capital of the U.S. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of it was just course correcting with the old department that did virtually nothing. Mm-hmm. Now they had more officers. Their officers were engaged in much more proactive activities. But those stats, which are covered... they were gathered through OPRA, Open Public Records Act requests. Those are very real. And I think the community responded, community groups, activist groups, that they didn't want that level of policing. Yeah. And to their credit, they did course correct, which they were unable to pivot during that old agency. So I think that shows signs of a much healthier organization and organizational culture that they're able to respond to intentional attempts to change.
Yeah, by the way, I want to read a couple more of those stats because they went from 495 tickets for failure to maintain lights on a vehicle to about 2,500 tickets. Mm. So that's a huge jump, five times as many tickets written. Also, the other thing I think that we should point out that changed was the use of technology. Cameras everywhere, 120 of them. And they were used. There was this data center. I remember doing a tour of this years ago.
A data center
that was used. And that was very helpful on how to deploy. They also had microphones. Can you talk about how technology...
Gunshot detecting microphones. I mean, I never even heard of this.
Could you talk about how technology was a pivotal factor in being able to bring some of those crime stats down?
Absolutely. So the Camden County PD invested heavily in technology. So every one of their police cars has an automated license plate reader. So every car that it passes, it scans the alphanumeric license plate and matches it with databases for stolen vehicles, stolen license plates, people with open warrants. They also have an acoustic gunshot detection system, basically these microphones lined up throughout the city of Camden that detects the sound of a muzzle blast, and so they could respond to a gunshot in like a minute compared to
waiting for someone to call.
Exactly,
and
they might never call. You know what research has shown is that in certain cities, sometimes 30% of the gun violence is not reported. So they invested in those things. Surveillance cameras. Basically, the city of Camden is unfortunately under near ubiquitous surveillance. So it helps the department in that when they have a suspect, they could basically trace that suspect back, you know, whether it's a car that dropped off a shooter or picked up a shooter. And so it's this double-edged sword in that it allows them to be more effective and make arrests, but it also subjects the citizens to near ubiquitous surveillance.
Yeah, Mark on Facebook says, Camden has become a surveillance state. There are so many cameras in Camden that even Big Brother is jealous. Anyone who sees this as a win is a fool, he says. There are plenty of ways to achieve safety without having a surveillance state. This is not how democracy works. That's according to Mark on Facebook. Maybe we should hear from somebody who was on the ground during that time. Yeah,
absolutely. And just another comment real quick, because Eustace says, they changed that city up. I'm very, very proud of them. Right? You see both ends of this here.
Yeah.
So let's bring in Chris Sarlo, Deputy Chief with the Camden County Police Department. First of all, Chris, thank you so much for being here. And I believe you came into this just as the change was starting. You're there on the ground in 2013. You came from, I think, a different department in the state of New Jersey. So I'm just curious first, Chris, why were you attracted to this opportunity? Because a lot of people would have run the other way seeing like big changes, thinking this is going to be very uncomfortable. Why did you want this post?
There were a couple reasons. I always wanted to be actually a Camden City police officer. So when the opportunity arose, that was already enough for me. But when I saw it was a new police department and it was a chance to effect change, to be on the ground level of something that was, as you guys were talking about, historic, something that there wasn't really a lot of precedence for, there's nothing more than I wanted than to be on the ground floor of that. And I'm glad I did, obviously.
Yeah. What were those early days like? Because you came in April 2013, mm-hmm. the big change happened in May. You know, what was it like having to, you know, implement these new strategies, mm-hmm. going door to door, getting to know the community? What was that like?
So I'll be honest, for me, it was strange, because most police departments, I was in my car. The previous police department I was in was a suburb, and we policed from our cars. You know, we would respond to calls from our cars. We would do traffic stops, and pretty much anything that you did was from the inside of a police car. So from in the beginning, we would get dropped off in a van in certain areas of the city. I was in Fairview for a while, which was actually kind of a homecoming for me, because I had family that lived in Fairview while I was growing up, so it was nice to be over there. But having to introduce myself to people that I have never met, knocking on random doors and explaining to people that were the new police department and asking them what the problems were and how they thought that we should fix it was something that I don't think anybody who started policing before that would have been used to. And now it's a common thing. Every single officer that graduates from our police academy, that is before they actually get assigned anywhere, they go out and do the exact same thing. So we've never even gotten away from that, because we found it successful to hear what the residents are thinking, because there might be things that they're not willing to tell us or willing to call about or willing to share. But once you start to build that relationship and that trust, you'll start to hear things that you might not have known otherwise.
Is there a conversation from those early days that you could remember that sticks out to you? It might have been one that was awkward, that didn't go well. It might have been one that you learned something you thought you would never learn. Now I'm asking you, putting you on the spot a little bit here, so if there isn't one, it's okay. But I'm just curious if there's an anecdote from that time that you're like, wow, if I was in my car, never would have had this type of interaction.
So actually, it was during the same day, and I actually remember it because I remember they took our picture and it wound up on like the county website or a newspaper or something. But myself and a partner were walking one of the streets right after we got done talking to somebody, and we were going to go up to a house, and there was a man outside, and he was not happy about the new police department. Honestly, he was very opposed to it. He said that, you know, we didn't know what we were doing, that why are you out here? You're not going to care about the community. And we took the time and asked him and said, why do you feel like that? And I was trying to win this guy over, and I wanted to know why he felt like that, because was there something that I wasn't aware of, or just what am I walking into almost? And he said, for example, my kid just got his bike stolen last night. He said, you guys were out here and I didn't get anything done from it. I didn't see anything. He still doesn't have a bike. And we talked for about 20 minutes. 5 minutes later, we see somebody driving his kid's bicycle. Mm. We grabbed the bicycle from him, we returned it. And it was actually after we returned it that they wound up taking our picture as we were talking to him. And he literally said, I'm so sorry. I cannot believe that you were able to do that right there. I mean, listen, I got lucky.
Yeah, but a little bit of fate. Yep.
It was, we definitely won somebody over right then and there.
Yeah.
And I remember that was my beat for probably about 3 months, where every single day I come out and he would say, hey, Chris, how's it going? And it was just, we made an ally just like that. And we were able to turn the corner with one person. And I'm sure every single officer here has experienced just like that.
Wow. Before we go to break, I just want to ask you, you know, Chris, how did this change your mindset about what it is and what it means to police a community?
So it totally changed my mindset from how you're taught in police academy to how policing is just done across the country and pretty much everywhere. It's, you're going to get in the car and you're going to drive around and somebody's going to call you and you're going to go to wherever that is for whatever is needed. Or you're going to see a motor vehicle violation and you're going to stop them and either write a ticket or not write a ticket or whatever winds up happening. And something that we found was after writing tickets and doing things, we realized that maybe not everybody needs a ticket to wear warnings over summonses, which was something that became almost a slogan here. But, you know, warnings over summonses is sometimes the way to go.
Yeah.
Where
yeah,
it could be a life-changing thing to someone in Camden City to write them a ticket.
Yep.
And it might not be that way somewhere else.
Yep.
So it was definitely different.
I just want to thank Deputy Chief Sarlo for his service to the people of Camden.
Absolutely.
It's a privilege to study police rather than actually engage in it.
Yeah. And I appreciate your time, Deputy Chief Chris Sarlo, for being with us on Studio 2. Very much appreciated. We'll be right back on Studio 2. Do not go anywhere.
Welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We're talking about Camden and how the city made a full 180 on their violent crime numbers. Once considered one of the most violent cities in the country, Camden just experienced a zero homicide summer. Earlier, we heard from Camden County's deputy police chief. Still with us right now is John Sharback, author of Chasing Change in Camden, Police Reform in One of America's Most Violent Cities.
And we invite you, our listeners, to participate in the conversation. A question for you is, what's your perception of Camden? Has it changed over time? And what needs to change to bring crime down in other parts of the region? You can give us a call. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, please share the video and then leave your comments in the chat.
And I want to make sure before I bring in our next guest that she is indeed with us. Can I get a thumbs up from the folks in the studio? Thumbs up. Great. Okay. We want to welcome a Camden County member into a Camden community member, into the conversation. Maria Hernandez is the director of Cure for Camden, a violence intervention program. She was on the ground during some of the most tumultuous times in Camden and continues to be involved today. Maria, welcome to Studio 2. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And so, Maria, I want you to take us back to 2012, 2013, when this new CCPD was sort of being created. What were your thoughts? Were you for this, you know, the dismantling of Camden Police Department? Did you have any thoughts about that at that time?
It was actually very big news in the city. Everybody was talking about it. At that time, I wasn't in the field, but I experienced losing somebody to gun violence in 2013. So I think I was, you know, I just wanted to see change. I wanted to see different. So I wasn't, you know, against it.
Yeah. And so what was it like when those new police officers are coming around, knocking on doors? What was it like for you being someone in the community watching this change happen?
It was definitely different. It was not something that we were used to. But in order to see change, I was all for it. You know, it was a really bad time in the area around that time. So it was good to see some type of change and just to see more of the police officers getting involved in the community.
Were there any parts of the change that you didn't like, you didn't appreciate, made you or other community members feel uncomfortable? And I'm just curious, like, if it was really all smooth sailing in that those transition years.
It wasn't smooth sailing. A lot of the police officers that came in when the change happened weren't from the city, opposed to when they were from the community. So getting to know the new officers and the officers getting to know the residents was a little bit hectic and a little bit difficult because they weren't from the area and they weren't used to, you know, having such, you know, people that suffer from a lot of traumatic experiences and just coming from the area, you know, approach them. Police officers don't really approach. We come from an area where you don't talk to the cops. You're not friendly with the cops. It was really different.
Yeah.
It was something getting to.
So how did the community relationship with police, how did you see it change? It used to, and I want you to kind of explain to me, this, you just mentioned that, you know, people weren't used to talking to police officers. Was there more of a, you know, it was a less friendly, you know, type of relationship? How did you see that shift? And what do you think was sort of the difference maker?
I think actually seeing the officers in the neighborhood was the difference maker. I think community policing was major in the city, and just building that relationship between the residents and the police officers, I think was key. Like I said, you don't talk to the police where I'm from. You're not friendly with the police. You mind your business. No matter what you see, what you hear, you just don't talk to them, you know? So them coming out to the community and showing people that they're actually were there to help, and, you know, and they were actually there to be a listening ear to the residents, and for the residents to actually see that change for, you know, as a difference, I think made that a little bit more easier to transition it, because I think it was more of the residents and seeing change in a neighborhood, not just hearing it, but actually seeing it. And I think just with the police presence and more of a police presence out in the neighborhoods and seeing more cops on bikes and just people in the area, you know, made people think twice about what they were going to get into.
Yeah.
Or what they were going to do.
Before,
it stopped them from doing a lot of things.
Before we get you out of here, Maria, but we've talked a lot about the police, but there's other people like you in the community working hard to make change over this entire period of time. And I'm curious how you saw that evolved and what you see the role of community groups and violence intervention advocates being in this overall story.
Yes. So I work for the Cure for Camden, Center for Family Services Cure for Camden program. I started off as an outreach worker working out in the communities in the hotspots, which were our target areas. I think violence intervention prevention also was major in the city, having people that actually lived through these experiences and being from the neighborhood. That could come out in the community and talk people out of doing certain things or being harmful to other people was also huge. Being able to talk them out of certain situations, building relationship with our youth and just letting them know that somebody was there for them, that somebody's there for them to listen to them, to be able to talk them out of getting themselves in a bad situation, in a bad life experience, where as though they won't be able to come back from that, or just ruin, you know, their future chances. So I think outreach work is major. Hospital responders are major. These people are here to listen. They're not necessarily here to get you in trouble, but they are here to help you change your life when it comes, and your thinking process when it comes to violence. And I think that being able to build that relationship with somebody, which also takes a very long time for them to trust you and be able to confide in you to talk them out of these situations, is also key, because everything is like word of mouth. Hey, I've been working with this outreach worker. She's been mentoring me. She's helped me a lot. She's talked me out of a lot of things that could have possibly put me in jail for the rest of my life. I think you should talk to her. And, you know, that's how we built relationships in the neighborhood. Just always being there, being present, being reachable when people call, and having a response, you know, just helping showing that you're able to help.
That is Maria Hernandez, Director of Cure for Camden. Thank you so much, Maria, for your time today on Studio 2.
And for your service to the community.
Should we bring in a caller here? This is Pastor Tim.
From Camden.
From Camden on the line. Hey, Pastor Tim, you're on Studio 2. We are getting close to the end of the hour, but if you could keep it tight, I'm just curious what your commentary, your insight is here.
Yes, I'm just a little concerned that the narrative here is feeding into authoritarianism, that it is policing that cures communities. And the real story of Camden, which I wish we had real time to get into, is that it's the parents, it's the neighbors, it's the teachers, it's the houses of worship, it is the community organizations. I know community organizations that are working in the worst neighborhoods, doing incredible work for years. That's the turnaround. It is not the policing. The police are there to respond to investigate and to solve crime. prevention work is done in the community. But every time we talk about Camden, it's always policing,
yeah.
which gives this administration in Washington the narrative to say, well, that's what you do. You send a bunch of police in and control these people. It's a damaging narrative that we have to move away from and find out what's really going on in the streets, that Camden is an older city now. When cities get older, their crime rates drop. It's a national trend. It is an emphasis on community service throughout the nation in our cities that is seeing this reduction in crime. Camden pays too much for policing. We are over-policed. I just wrote a novel about the surveillance state in Camden, what it could be. Because we are over-surveilled, we are over-policed, and there are other factors that are making our city a lot safer. I met with the mayor last week. Mm-hmm. He agreed, but the spin keeps on leading with police, and I think that's a mistake.
Thank you, Pastor Tim. Yeah. Important counterweight.
Yeah, and do you want to respond to that, John?
Sure. I do think that we give a little bit too much credit to police.
Mm-hmm.
And in the city of Camden, there's a lot of things that have been going on that have contributed likely to the reduction in crime and violence. We had Maria on, Camden, mm-hmm. Cure for Camden. It's a community-based violence intervention group. There are certain individuals that do not trust the police. And when they experience violence, they want to engage in retaliatory violence.
Mm-hmm.
And so her group is involved at Cooper Hospital. Whenever someone does get assaulted, shot, they try to talk, they try to prevent retaliatory homicides and shootings. And so that's one factor. The city has been engaged in a big campaign to demolish vacant and abandoned buildings.
Mm-hmm.
They've improved street lighting. All these things we know, based on the evidence, reduces crime. And so while the Camden County PD plays a role, don't get me wrong, they play a role. They're not the end-all, be-all. There mm-hmm. are a lot of community-based solutions that we need to give praise to. We need to spread that praise.
And some of the root causes, that are directly tied to crime, deal with poverty. And I want to know, talk about that, because there's all this revitalization going on in Camden. Are the residents sort of getting any of the benefits of this, such that those root causes are being dealt with?
Yeah, so half of the kids who grow up in Camden are in poverty. And I think 80% grow up in female-headed households. Until we address that, we're never going to see, a year with zero homicides. Mm. They still have a about 4.7 times the national rate homicide that in 2024.
Right.
So things have not been cured.
Yeah. And I think I put it out in the beginning of the show, but I think the 18 they had last year would have equivalent to, like, maybe 400 plus homicides in Philadelphia. So it's still a pretty high number.
Absolutely. Yeah. Almost five times. So
that gives us, I think that leads me to the question of, does this whole story also show us maybe the extent of how far police reform can truly take you in solving a crime and revitalizing a city?
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the redevelopment has really been on the waterfront, right?
Right.
It hasn't necessarily been into the neighborhoods.
No. I think good policing buys you time. And it allows you to respond to things, proximate causes. But you're never really addressing the root causes when you have an unequal economic revitalization effort. So the majority of the money that has been brought into Camden has been on the waterfront. During the Chris Christie administration, $1.6 billion went to the city of Camden. 1.1 of the $1.6 billion were attached to George Norcross and his affiliated companies and partners and whatnot. Very little has trickled down
mm-hmm.
into the actual neighborhoods. And the people of Camden actually created a law where they wanted to know what percentage of these companies that get hundreds of millions of dollars in tax breaks. We're talking about Subaru. We're talking about
mm-hmm.
The Philadelphia 76ers.
Yeah.
I think you're a fan of the 76ers.
Yeah, I am, yeah.
Yeah.
The practice facility.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They did that for the tax break. And so when you have that type of unequal economic revitalization that does not trickle down into the majority of neighborhoods, you're putting an undue burden on the police.
Yeah.
It just buys you time. We need to buy time, but also solve underlying issues.
There's some of, like, a stabilization has happened, but the sort of making
Camden better for the people who live there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You've triaged, but you haven't really necessarily recovered in some ways.
I mean, 50% of kids in Camden still don't graduate high school. You're never going to address crime and violence. Even though we've made it better, it's no longer 18 times the homicide rate. Yeah. It's 4.7. That's still almost five times the rate, the national average.
Yeah. And if we were to, you know, we only have 45 seconds left in the show, but I wonder if there's some lessons that can, that you think can be taken from this, as far as, you know, they have more work to do, but what are some of the takeaway lessons?
I would like to see more of a data-informed community engagement model where policing in Camden, they're not the monopoly on public safety. They incorporate more community groups, business association groups to meet weekly, monthly, to go over where the problems are, provide risk narratives as to why, you know, crime is spiking in certain areas. There are great models in Newark with the Newark Public Safety Collaborative in St. Louis. And I think that's what I would love to see in Camden moving forward.
So there could be more done.
More done. That's John Scharback. The book is Chasing Change in Camden, Police Reform in One of America's Most Violent Cities. So thankful that you were here this hour, John.
Yes, thank you guys for having me.
And now it's time to reveal our Studio 2 DJ of the Day song. Let's hit it quickly.
Oh, make me wanna holler the way they do my
Yes, that's Inner City Blues by Marvin Gaye from his masterpiece 1971 album, What's Going On.
Thank you to Jack from Springfield for choosing that song and being our DJ of the day.
Love it. And Studio 2 gives thanks to Debbie Bilton and Andreas Copes, our producers, and to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, to Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk to you again next week.